Welcome to Down the Garden Path. I'm your host, Joanne Shaw, landscape designer and plant lover. I enjoy discussing down-to-earth tips and advice to help you seasonally manage your garden and landscape. And I also aim to bring you interesting and relevant topics to educate you all about the landscaping and horticultural industry. Today, my guest is Margot Ann Kelly, and Margot is a writer and photographer whose work focuses on the natural world. Her new book, A Gardener at the End of the World, explores some of the complex relationships connecting people, seeds, and viruses, and traces strands of our collective co-evolution. Kelly has been growing vegetables and herbs for over 20 years. Currently, she does so in the mid-coast Maine, where long summer days and strategic plant choices help make up for the shortness of the season. Welcome to the show, Margot.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
And I just love talking to other gardeners. So it's a little different show. This is our first guest of the season talking to an author about a book. And I think it's a really beautiful written book that covers a lot. I know we chatted a little bit before the show, but why don't you tell me how you came about? Did it start out as a book? Was it just more a journal to help you during that period of time?
That's a great question. And the answer is no, it wasn't originally going to be a book. So I started keeping a pandemic journal because I had a feeling I was going to want one. I was going to want to be able to look back at some point and think through what was happening. And the other thing that was going on was really, really early in the pandemic. I had applied in January before things started for an artist residency on a farm. And I was interested in learning more about seeds and seed saving. And then in April, I got two emails in one day. The first one said, "Yay, you've been selected." And the second one said, "Given the circumstances, we've decided not to run them this year." But they invited me to do a virtual residency, and which is an oxymoron, of course, but yes. I was trying to think about what I could do as a virtual residency. And so I thought, all right, I can't do the kind of seed saving that I was thinking about on that farm, but I could learn more about seeds. And so my pandemic journal and my interest in seeds became the raw material out of which the book started to evolve.
Excellent. And also your own garden, because like many across the world, a lot of people did turn to gardening as and the way the season went too. You know, it kind of was March when everybody's getting outside, and you know, so it was a very well documented journey through the book and through that period of time through your own garden.
Yeah, my garden was my happy place, definitely, during the pandemic. And because I had to stay home, I had the chance to do my very best to make my garden great that year. Yes. And I felt like that was kind of a clap back, that I was saying, okay, there's death all around. There's a lot of scariness, a lot of anxiety, but I am going to cultivate life. And so I really focused on trying to have a really fecund garden that year and to grow a lot of things, try some new experiments. And I had been, I'd had super plant lust in the middle of the winter before that, which you probably know well yourself.
Yes, and yeah.
So for the first time, I ordered warming mats. And so I had warming mats, so I got to start things a little bit early. And that was also such a respite especially during March, to just have plants to go out and look at and to watch and see when they broke the soil.
Yeah, it's amazing that, well, not amazing to us, but we need to tell other people, it is amazing to watch plants grow.
And, it's incredible.
Yeah. You know, growing something from seed, as much as I don't do that as much as I'd like, even growing baby plants and planting little things and watching them grow, there's just nothing like it.
There isn't. And it was really heartening. Every morning I would go out and I would check and I'd come back in the house and say, now there are six, now there are 10.
Yeah.
And my husband was very patient. He's great. That's great.
That's good. And you have a greenhouse as well.
I do. I do. And I had gotten that a few years earlier, in no small part because we only have one room in our house besides our bedroom and bathroom where we can close the door and keep the cats out. And as it turns out, cats love baby plants on windowsills. And so we decided that we were going to splurge and get a greenhouse so that we could start things in a safer environment that was cat-free. And also because Maine is a tough, tough climate to grow things. And it gave us a few more options in terms of the things that we could grow.
Right. What zone is Maine?
Well, I used to be 5A, but we
Okay.
just got reclassified as 5B.
So similar to us. So
Yeah.
we, I think we're 5B and are just getting reclassified to 6A.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's changing for sure.
It is changing. Yeah. And I mean, if you asked an apple orchardist, they would have told you that 10 years ago. But the USDA has just recently said, yes, indeed, these zones are changing.
Yes, they did reclassify everything, but it wasn't that long ago when they reclassified it the last time. Like I
I
always thought
know.
it was many years, you know, like at least a decade in between, but I don't think it's been a decade in
It
between.
doesn't feel like that. I feel like when we got here, we were 4B. Yeah.
And I know that even for, I mean, not with food, but with ornamental plants, when I started gardening and designing, that there were some plants that were borderline, like you kind of
Right.
planted them, but you treated them like an annual. You know, there was a really good chance it wasn't going to make it, and now they're basically perennials.
Yeah.
You know, and
Yeah. We have a Stewardia tree in front of our kitchen window, and it is protected on the left by the barn and on the front on the other side by the house. And if it weren't for the barn and the house being right there, I don't think that a Stewardia would thrive here at all.
yeah. But then it gives us a chance to grow things that we weren't able to grow before, you know, either, right? So
True,
it's kind of
true.
like a tricky situation.
I know it is.
Yes. So have you always in had that knowledge or that desire to learn more about seeds?
I don't know as always, but I think I can actually trace it because maybe 5 or 8 years after I started growing things, I came across something called the Raft Project, which was renewing America's food traditions,
Okay.
RAFT. And
Okay.
what they had done is they had made lists by region of historically important foods that were endangered, threatened, or extinct. And they encouraged people to grow these endangered or threatened foods. And so in our region, one of them was a half a dozen kinds of beans and a couple of kinds of carrots and three kinds of tomatoes. And so I thought, well, this is an interesting principle to try and bring into my garden is to say, these marrow fat beans are a little bit at risk, and they're delicious. And if I grow them, they'll be infinitely tesimally less at risk, but still a tiny bit less at risk.
Yes.
And so my garden started being populated by a lot of historical plants. And the more I did that, the more interested I became in plants and in seed saving in general.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know here we have like even a certified, you can get certified to be a certified seed collector. There's a
Oh,
certification
that's
program. I know
cool.
because a good friend of mine, a fellow landscape designer, we affectionately call her Farmer Janet because there, you know, two Janets and she's the farmer one. And so she is a passionate gardener and has a little farm with chickens and goats. Goats don't really help the farm her help her plants much because they eat them,
No.
but and pigs and cattle. And she loves native plants. And so last fall she did that course to be a certified seed collector.
That's really cool. Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm not a, I do some seed saving, but the truth is I do the easy ones.
Yeah.
I do peas and beans and things like that. I don't even do tomatoes, just that extra step. I'm like, I'm not sure how well I'll do with them, but I do save what I can sort of save relatively easily.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is tricky and it's just a whole other level, right?
It is. It
Yeah.
is. And there are a lot of people who are way better at it doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a lot of work and effort to raise all of those plants and get them, you know, so making we've got to just do what we can do. The food, the history of food, I also find very fascinating. Another thing my husband and I do when we travel, in addition to me looking at obsessing of trees, what we were talking about beforehand, is we often will do when we get to a new place, do a food tour. Because we learned quickly that it isn't just about the food. Like, yes, you get bonus, you get food, you know, but the history of that food in that area and the history of the background of it in, and so it's really a great way to learn about one, the food, but also a different culture. And so yeah, so that is something that I find very fascinating. But even learning, which you were talking about a lot about Columbus and the food he, you know, and that was such a the book, you laid it out very well because it is a bit of a dichotomy in the sense that him going back and forth, bringing viruses and illness and causing, unfortunately, death. But also the importance of bringing the food and back and forth as well, and being able to grow things in different areas. I mean, I found that really fascinating, and that is all of our history, really, right?
It is. It is. And it's a struggle for me because in the United States especially, people just want to cancel Columbus now.
Yeah.
And I understand that tremendous, tremendous harm was wrought. But I also understand that potatoes are a new world vegetable that he brought back to Europe, and it saved millions of people who lived in poverty in the European continent, in Ireland, in England, and none of those people or their descendants would exist right now if the potato hadn't made it to Europe. And so it gets tricky, you're right, when you try and assess, like, how do we really feel about what happened? We know that all these foods moved. We know that people carried them wherever they went. But it's not unreasonable to find fault with Columbus. But if we take a step back, we see that it's part of a more complicated and nuanced situation.
Absolutely. And I had never heard that specifically about the potato. I mean, we all have heard about the potato, you know, that potato saved Ireland. You know, Outlander, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, infection has been covered, right? But that fact though, that if he hadn't have done that, they wouldn't have had them. So I think you're right. There's always a flip side to things. And the benefits of, you know, the tomatoes and the potatoes and the things. And I feel like we should almost be looking more closely at that history for, because there are places in the world that are still suffering from famines and still, and because of climate change, they're not able to grow what they normally were able to grow. So I think looking to, you know, those solutions about, okay, well, who's growing, you know, now that the climate has changed, who's growing something, you know, who's growing in that type of climate.
I totally agree. I think about things like manioc that, have become staples in certain environments, or taro root or yams. And it's like, okay, if this is a drought resistant version, great. But what if it isn't? Can we create a drought resistant version? And I'm a person who's really a little bit hesitant about genetic modification, but I'm not hesitant about using crossing of existing genomes within a certain plant line
I
and
agree.
saying, let's improve this one and make it so that it will work in a zone 3 or a zone 9 or whatever, like, so that we have opportunities. And that's part of what I'm really interested in seed saving, is that if we keep the germ from a million or 2 million plant lines that are things that we can eat, then when the 11 or 12 that we rely on for 90% of our food start to be problematic for us, whether it's because there's too much drought, there's too much water, there's too much wind in a certain climate, we're going to have opportunities to make something that works better in that environment.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is really important, but I worry that nobody's looking at that. Like who's draw, you know what I mean? Like it's not like a clear cut, right?
I know, I know. I think at some ag departments and some universities are doing it, but we need a lot more people doing it. And
Yeah.
that's part of the other reason that I like to save those historical seeds, 'cause who knows what great attribute they have that only they have, or maybe 10 different kinds of beans have this particular resistance to this particular fusarium or whatever.
Yeah.
And if we keep them, then we have that opportunity to use that genetic material in the future. But if we just let it go because we're not crazy about the taste of that one bean, then we're really doing ourselves a disservice.
But I think it even goes higher than that above the gardener and just in governments to realize the importance of something like the seed banks and protection of that. You know, I know that was one of the things that closed in Ontario when the government changed and panic kind of ensued with all the gardeners about like this is important
Yeah.
and I'm trying to think of even the most recent episode or series. I don't know if you're a True Detective fan, but like they were doing it in the Arctic and they, you know, just talking about the how important it was, you know, the food that they could grow and you know, it just shows you that the what how important it is. You know, it
It's
is,
critical.
it's
Yeah.
critical, and it sh could be helping people in the future. We just re recently traveled to South America on a cruise, but you know, we were able to kind of stop and get a peek at all the different countries all the way around. And we had a lovely tour guide on one and talked about this area of Argentina and. It really, Spain was worried, you know, that it was not inhabited enough. Happened to be where the
Yeah.
Pe Magellan penguins are, so it was great. But so they really wanted to encourage people to move there. At the same time, the Welsh, you know, left England because they didn't want to speak there. You know, well, England was telling them, you know, you're not speaking English and that type of thing. So they kept going to all these different countries, including Canada, including trying to find a new home.
Yep.
And it never worked out until they finally landed there. And they were welcomed with open arms, despite the language differences and all of this land. And they, because they were farmers and they wanted to farm. And at this area off of Puerto Madryn in Argentina, they welcomed the Welsh and they said, please, you know, turn this into farms. Well, it's almost a desert there and very dry and very windy. And so they came and then they realized that their wheat and their things that they wanted to grow couldn't grow. Well,
Yeah.
what they did, I don't know enough, and the guy didn't know enough about whether they changed the seed, you know, the plants, but they, and it's not like they invented irrigation, but they went through the work of better irrigating the land. So from the ship to the penguins and to the coast was like a 2.5 hour drive of desert. And then in the middle of nowhere, you would see all of a sudden see a house and trees and lushness. And it was kind of like, and as me, I'm like, how can we be driving and not see trees? Like there were no trees. Everything was, you know, 2 feet tall. And then you know that was the Welsh. Those are the Welsh farmers, and this is many, 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 many generations. And they still, in the middle, they were able to do it, and they were able to transform the landscape. And that just so reading your book and realizing, you know, how that it just all kind of tied together for me. And you know, in a
That's
different,
awesome.
you know, and that's why we travel, right? Just to learn about different destinations and see 100-year-old trees,
Exactly,
right?
exactly. And see what's different. Like, I grew up on the East Coast. I live on the East Coast now. If I didn't travel, I wouldn't know that other places have completely different soil, completely different trees. And that would be a loss.
Yeah.
I wouldn't appreciate my home nearly as much, and I wouldn't understand the incredible variety across this continent. It's shocking to fly over this continent.
Yeah, it really is. And I think the one thing in North America, so both between, you know, Canada and the US for both of us, one thing when I go to other countries and see how much more care, I don't know if it's care is the word, but or respect, but how much more they work with the trees as opposed to cutting the trees down, you
Yeah.
know? And sometimes that's not great. Like I, there was some, Buenos Aires, there was some, like the whole, you basically out our window of where we stayed, like the trees were touching the, like the leaves were coming into the port, you know, like that's how
Oh,
close the building was to the trees, and the
yeah.
trees were, you know, the boulevard trees. But you very rarely see in these places where they're young boulevard trees. These are all, they'll prune them and keep them going. And even though there are harsh conditions, we all know boulevard trees in a city, regardless of the city, it's not the easiest condition for, you know, they're
No.
surrounded by concrete and asphalt. But they deal with it and they let the tree be the tree, and they might not look as beautiful, but where I feel like in North America, oh, there, we need to do this, and oh, there's a tree there. Well, we can move the tree, or we can cut the tree down, or you know, or we'll
Yeah.
plant a tree somewhere else. It's okay, but it's not okay, you know.
Right.
And so that's, I'm always amazed at the maturity of all the trees.
Yeah.
And
One of the things that really caught my attention in traveling and learning about people's ideas about their environment around them is that in Belgium, what we would call pocket parks, the little parks that are in a neighborhood, they call them lungs. And
really?
isn't that beautiful?
That is so
Yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah. Because, they do the work that lungs do. And I assume that's why they call them lungs, because they do the work that lungs do. But I just thought that, okay, there's a deep understanding written into the language of why this piece of this small little park is important, why we need this bit of grass, why we need these trees.
Yeah, I mean, I look to, I have to admire New York City, like the fact that that city is, has managed to maintain Central Park, you know,
Right,
like
right.
it's amazing. Yet the, you know, in Toronto, we're fighting for every little piece.
Yeah,
It's,
no, New York, I mean, part of it was that that park was made early.
yes.
But it's amazing, given the pressure on the land in New York City, that it is still whole.
And you know, you could have seen, like, I could see them not like taking it over, but you could see scope creep kind of happening, right? And it didn't, it
Definitely.
hasn't.
Yeah.
And I think that's, and when you're there in it, you don't realize how big it is. But when you see the pictures, you know, and you see it on TV, and you're like, wow,
Yeah,
that is
yeah.
in New York City, that is a lot of land.
It
And just
is.
the foresight of people. And actually, the one thing, speaking of foresight, a little bit of a segue, but I want to segue to the part where you did the little, you know, history about Jefferson and Adams, yeah, talking about presidents.
Yep.
And that just fascinated me. I think that's a whole book on itself.
I do too. I know they were smart.
They were. So they, like, literally, what did he say? Yeah. Oh, he said something about the people that lead, their leaders should be gardeners.
Yes, he
What did
thought
you?
that only people who were farmers should be allowed to be in Congress, because they were, quote, the true Americans. They understood.
Yeah,
That's amazing.
that was amazing. And they were true representatives of the great American interest.
Yeah.
The leaders' emphasis on farming, both in their actions. Oh, you know, oh, I don't know. I just thought that was fascinating, and we're, and sad all at the same time, because we've really are far from that now. And especially at the way the people are being, making climate change and the climate so politicized, as opposed to really embracing that we're, this is for all of us, and we
Yeah.
really need to understand and throw everything we can at it. So
Absolutely. Yeah.
Did writing the book, was it, I'm guessing it was very therapeutic for you through the pandemic.
It was. And one of the things I recount in the book is that one of my friends thought I was bonkers to be reading about, like, the Spanish flu and syphilis and the Black Plague during the pandemic. But it actually was helpful. And it was helpful for a couple reasons. First of all, we survived all those things. Human species survived these things that were really terrible, in moments when we didn't understand how we got sick, We didn't understand how to get well. We didn't have the resources to like do an Operation Warp Speed and try and like create the virus, the vaccine. And still we prevailed. And so that was hugely important. And then the other thing that was important was that like the more personal level, I could see that these things happen in arcs. I could see that there was a first wave, then a second wave that was worse, and then a third wave. And then mostly they abated. They didn't completely disappear, but they abated. And so it gave me a sense when we didn't have really a calendar for figuring out, like, when can we hope that this starts to go away? Yeah. I could say, well, historically, this is kind of what happened again and again. And yes, this one could be different than the other ones, but if it follows a similar trajectory, then by the time you and I are here talking, we know that it hasn't gone away, but it has become endemic, and that it will crop up again every couple months or couple years, but it won't be like 2020. It'll never be like 2020 again from COVID.
From COVID, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating too that, like you said, the arcing, that even though history, like, yes, we've got the history to look back on, but things have changed so much in the sense of flying and you know, that it moves faster.
But
at the same time, we had that technology also move faster to, and the expertise to treat it where they didn't back
right.
then. But it shows you, though, that despite all of our advances and everything that we know prior to 2020, that the pandemic still happened, you know?
Right.
It's, you know, all of our knowledge and technology and cleanliness practices that were normal back then and now probably not as sufficient as what we're doing now, but yeah, that it just still didn't prevent it, you know?
Right. And I will say, I still wash my hands a lot longer than I used to before the pandemic. And I thought I was doing it long enough before the pandemic,
yeah.
But now, you know, it's, there are some bits that I think we'll retain. I still see a lot of folks in the grocery store with masks on. And that was something that I only very infrequently saw before the pandemic. So people are cognizant about their own health and maybe about other people's health a little bit more than we used to be.
Yes, because you don't know what someone else has going on. Oh, and that leads me to your mom. How is your mom?
Thank you so much. She's good. I was
She's
with her
good.
last Monday. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, that's challenging. You know, I know we were kind of in a bubble with my in-laws to a certain degree, and which was good. But like you said, you were far away and it didn't make sense. And my parents were far away, and that was much harder too.
Yeah.
To not be able to see them and doing Zoom. And, you know, it's just not the same. So
it's not, it's
yeah.
not, it's, it was awesome to be able to just go down there last Monday, spend the day and be worry-free for both
Yes.
of us. Yeah.
Yes. And I think even that's one thing when we travel now too, and just coming back from this trip, you know, it still is in every washroom, like the signs on how to wash our hands and in every language. So important, you know, about why and the why, you know, and so there, so I think it's, the world went through it together, and some places handle it better than other places. But I think it's changed how everybody did everything. And it was cute when we did get to see I got to see the Magellan penguins, which oddly are warm water penguins. They don't like cold. And so that's why they were in the desert. There was no snow. You know, when you picture a penguin, you picture snow. Well,
Totally.
these are not them, but they had painted little. And so it was very well done as far as protecting, letting people see them, but also protecting their habitat. And so they built this long, long, long boardwalk. And they had little penguin footprints, and they were like, you know how outside of stores, like,
Oh
stand this far apart? Well, they had that, like, stand this far back from the penguins. So it was very cute. So, I mean, it has changed the whole world.
It has. It
And
definitely has.
I think the way your book, you know, you, like you said, you kind of framed it by the garden, your year in your garden.
That's right. Yeah. But I also, the frame from the pandemic is from, I start gardening roughly the same time that we went into lockdown.
Yep.
And I finish gardening usually in early December because the last thing that we pull from our garden here is carrots that have gone through a frost. And you probably know that once they've gone through a frost, they're sweeter. And so if we can leave them in just until they've gone through one or two, not a super hard frost because we don't want them to turn to mush, but a frost. And it turns out that that's for us usually first or second week of December. And that was the same time basically that vaccines got authorized. And so I felt like that was like a perfect double overlay because we had the pandemic overlay and the garden year overlay, and they kind of matched up. And so it's not an exact full year, it's a garden year.
Yes, a garden year. A garden year. I mean, I mentioned earlier, like, I mean, how do you end it? Like, how did you decide the best way to end the book?
And so that when the vaccines were announced, I was like, this is perfect. I'll end right here. And then, of course, as any gardener knows, just a few days later, I got my first catalog for 2021. So it was, I had got a seed catalog and I was like, yes, okay, I can end on a happy note because I can open my seed catalog and I can imagine a year that's not like the one we just went through.
And I think it was a lovely how the whole industry boomed. You know, one of the bad, sad, happy outcomes was people are looking at growing their own food and paid much more attention to how their food was being grown, where it was being grown. You know, the fear of not being able to have enough, how it has benefited farmers and farmers markets and CSAs, you know, where people are getting the food right directly from the farmer. I think, you know, that it's hard to, you know, something so mind-blowingly bad happened, but there were little, as far as gardening goes and plants and food, I think there were some, you know, good side to it.
There were some silver linings.
There you go. That's better to say silver linings.
Because like for us, since our garden's really big, we don't normally belong to a vegetable CSA, but we joined one in 2020 in the spring because the shelves were bare and our garden wasn't going to be producing for a few more months. And that CSA was kind enough to let people join in March. And so we didn't get a lot of choices. We had a lot of microgreens and a lot of turnips and carrots and stuff. But we didn't have the panic. Well, we had a little bit of the panic of going to the grocery store, but we had less than we would have had if we didn't have access to a CSA. And their CSA has continued to grow in the years since, in no small part because people who were completely unexposed to CSAs before 2020 realized that they're kind of awesome.
They really are. And the introduction to foods that they may not have bought at the grocery store that are in the CSA and that they need to eat it and figure out how to cook it. You know, it's another silver lining. And I was mentioning earlier too that as a landscape designer, when I first started as a young designer, you know, young couples would buy a house with maybe from an older couple, and it would have had a couple of fruit trees, and it would have had like an old framed area where the, you know, the previous owners grew vegetables. And back then they were like, okay, can we, when we take that out, how can we take that vegetable garden out, or can we take out the fruit trees and put in something else? That was the mentality. And now it's completely changed. And now we're planting every garden, everyone I visit pretty much wants a place to grow food, whether it's in containers or they're asking me their best way that they could grow something. Their increased interest in fruit trees. You know, the fact that there are now much more dwarf varieties, you
Right,
know,
that helps a lot.
that helps a lot. Self-pollinating, that helps a lot. But that there is not that fear where, you know, 15 years ago, there was that fear of, oh no, we're going to need chemicals and the fruit's going to attract bugs and, you know what I mean? All the negatives. And people now are looking at the positives. Like, I want my children to be able to, you know, eat fruit off of the tree. And the children were involved too, of enjoying the food and learning about how it grows. So I think that was a really a cool side benefit. And I don't know when it'll stop because it's still going on. I mean, you know, the gardeners that I'm dealing with just the season, food is still part of it.
It's still happening here because one of the things that we were really struck by in 2020, I help out with our local food bank, and not just me, every gardener in town was spending more time in her garden or his garden. And so we had so much surplus that we were bringing all the surplus to the food pantry. And we had so much that the day after the food pantry clients would come, we would have a free market that anybody could come to. And that's still happening. We still have that in July and August, for especially because more people started gardening and more people have like become better gardeners. Like even the people like me who were okay, pretty good gardeners before 2020, we spent so much time in our gardens that year that we really kind of figured things out.
Right. Yes, and the weather every year changes too, right? So some things do better than other depending, right? It's so no two gardening
Definitely.
years are ever the same thanks to the
Oh no.
weather. So then that, the years you have the surplus of zucchini and the years you have the surplus of tomatoes, we're not necessarily the same year.
No, they're
So
not, but it all gets eaten.
that's right. That's right. So, but I do like how you ended, and I think that was a hopeful ending. But I think there were a lot of lessons in your book, and even though it is, I don't want to say it's about the pandemic. Like the pandemic happened during your book, the first year of the growing year of the pandemic. But I feel that you were able to educate the reader on the history of pandemics and tying that into the history of food and how food, like the potato, the journey of the potato alone was just fascinating. So I want to thank you. I think it was a gardener at the end of the world is your book. And I just want to let our listeners know that they should check it out. We will have all your contact information and where they can purchase the book. Is it on Amazon
It's on
or?
Amazon. Yep. It's
Perfect.
already there for pre-order. And
Excellent.
yeah, and it's going to be widely available, I think.
Wonderful. And do you have a new project? Is there something you're working on now, aside from your garden and growing seeds?
Right now, it's just getting ready for the growing season, but I do have some inklings of a potential new project. It's just too early to even talk about. Yeah.
Okay, no problem. I understand
Thank
completely.
you.
Oh, so we'll look forward to it. But yeah, so we'll have all your contact information and where everyone could reach out and buy your book in our
Super.
show notes. So thank you
Great.
very much
Thank you.
for joining me down the garden path today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.